You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Thank you, Scott. Hi, everybody. Let's talk about the markets at this hour. We have stocks moving off of their lows, but still to the downside. The Dow down about 85 points right now. The S&P and NASDAQ also negative. Dow was down 200 or so at the lows. It still remains on track for its biggest weekly gain in 6 weeks. So something to keep in mind today as we continue to see these declines. It's been a tug of war over two big headlines today. The bears watching news out of China that they would retaliate if the U.S. undermines its interests. The bulls listening to New York Governor Cuomo announced improving coronavirus numbers. Let's run through all of it now with Bob Pisani. Hi, Bob.
Kelly, you're absolutely right. There's a tug and pull and tug here, let's just call it, between the bulls and the bears today. Let's just take a look at the S&P 500 because we're down a little bit right now, but I still see evidence of the market broadening out. But let me just show you the intraday on the S&P 500. You see that dip there in the middle of the day? That's when we started getting headlines. Beijing threatens U.S. with countermeasures if sanctions are imposed. Remember, this is a big market move for China. Reopening, stimulus, treatment, China relations. Those are the big four things that move the markets. And you have one of those we're talking about today. But overall, let's look at the sectors today. I still see evidence of a rebalancing, a bit more broadening out in the market. So look, the Russell 2000 up again today. That's been a laggard. Retail up again. Industrials have been a laggard. Banks are relative outperformers. Energy is the one thing that's definitely underperforming the overall market, although that's been better recently. Mega cap, I would say not a big factor today, although I see Facebook as another new high, just keeps on going. But everything else on the flattish side there. Retail having a good day. I like reading TJX's report. This is the TJ Maxx parent here. They had, well, they had a loss there in terms of their earnings, but sales were a lot better than expected. And some of their overall sales, their comp store sales, actually were a lot better than people anticipated. Move up there and you see Ross. We'll get that after the bell, I believe, Ross Stores. Guys, back to you.
Yeah, and Kohl's rebounding too after its earnings report. I didn't realize that. Bob, thanks very much, as always. Bob Pisani running through things for us. Let's get to the latest, those stunning numbers in the housing report today. Existing home sales in April dropping to the lowest point in 10 years nearly as the market got a 1-2 punch from inventories and prices. Let's get to Diana Olick with all of the details for us. Diana?
Yeah, Kelly, closed sales fell nearly 18% for the month. And believe it or not, that was a little better than expected. The bigger shock was supply, which was already really weak before the pandemic, but fell nearly 20% annually to the lowest April reading ever as current sellers pulled their listings and very few new sellers entered the market. That pushed the median price to a record high $286,800. Even though mortgage rates jumped in March when most of these contracts were signed and lending tightened up. So competition among whoever was out there was clearly fierce. And one really interesting stat in all this, condo sales fell much more sharply than single family, leading the realtor's chief economist to suggest a potential long-term trend of people fleeing the cities and heading out to the burbs. Kelly, and I know we've talked about that a lot.
Yes, near and dear to my heart. Diana, thanks. I've seen it play out in the neighborhood. We're going to talk more about this now. What is going on in the housing market? As bad as April home sales were, was that the bottom? And how quickly should the market recover? Joining me now to talk about the path forward for real estate is Ryan Gorman, the CEO of Coldwell Banker Real Estate with more than 94,000 agents worldwide. So, Ryan, welcome. Must be have been a very stressful period the first month or two of this. My neighbor's house was for sale kind of right as this all hit. So I certainly know how anxious it can be. But talk about when you think activity bottomed and some of the new tools that might be helping the market rebound.
Certainly. Well, some of the data that we're seeing within Coldwell Banker, within our parent company, Realogy, points to April having been a bit of a bottoming out on the opens or new contracts written side. We saw some information from the National Association of Realtors this morning that was just referenced that seemed to point to that as well. And we've seen week over week increases since that time in units as well as new mortgage applications.
Yeah, one of the most stunning things that I heard from Diana already this week was that mortgage applications to purchase a home are only down 1.5% from this time last year. That is stunning. Is there a little bit of catch-up, almost accelerating housing demand going on, Ryan, because people are trying to look for properties that are more stable, maybe outside of the urban areas they've been renting?
I think there's a lot of truth to that. I think what we saw, when I look at the data, the highest correlation I see between activities in the housing market and more general activities, it really has to do more with the state orders. As the states locked down to try and keep us all safe, What we saw was listings not able to come onto the market because, for instance, we had trouble getting photographers into homes. And we saw buyer demand really bottled up. Now, as we see counties, cities, and states lifting some of those orders, we're seeing listings come onto the market much more quickly, trying to catch up to that 20% deficit that we was noted earlier, as well as buyers getting into properties as quickly as they can, using a lot of the virtual tools that we at Coldwell Banker and others have made available to view the properties, but really wanting to get in there themselves before they make a final offer.
You know, I was chuckling. We have a video. I don't think we have the music with it, but it's a neighborhood tour that one of your real estate brokers had taken to kind of show the prospective buyer not just the house, but the area around it. And it had, you know, Drake going in the background. And I've seen you guys have these videos on TikTok. And could you talk a little bit about what the market segment is that you're trying to reach that way? I mean, how young are these buyers? Or is it that, you know, hey, Drake listeners are older than we think they are?
Sure. Well, there's been a tremendous transition. So we do have entrepreneurial agents all over the country and all over the world. Coldwell Banker operates in more than 40 countries. And what they're doing is leveraging a lot of consumer tools as well as Coldwell Banker proprietary tools to try and bring those listings and the neighborhoods to life for clients. And what we're actually seeing is it's not just millennials who are open to this. 60 and 70% of all the buyers that we're surveying are open to looking at areas and properties and even potentially making offers on properties, having only seen them virtually right now, which I think speaks a lot to the pent-up demand. I don't think the long-term trend will be that everyone will only look virtually at a property to make an offer, but I do think they're valuing their time and their safety, trying to use some of those virtual tools to take a look at a property, weed out some, and then make an offer.
Yeah, because certainly getting a real walkthrough with a camera is much better than just a slideshow that we used to see for the most part. So I'm also curious, you know, a lot of people, I imagine, it's important for them that there's a home office or some kind of dining room or maybe extra bedroom that can serve as that. Is the sort of features that people are looking for, is that changing? And can you also speak to the price points? You know, the high price point has been a chronic feature of this housing market. I wonder, you know, if you expect that to come down or to go up.
Absolutely. I'll speak to both. So on the first, we are seeing a trend. The top three trends right now, number one, no surprise, you mentioned it, is home offices. So that always been a lighter demand, and now we're seeing it rise to the number one most requested item as we all figure out how to work from home. I'm currently in my middle school son's bedroom at the moment, so having a home office might work out well for folks. The next two trends we've seen before, but moving more towards rural areas for the primary residence, if you can work from home a little more often, and for that secondary or vacation residence. And then the private outdoor space, it's always trended very highly, but it's trended even more highly most recently. That speaks a little bit to some of what we're seeing on the high end as well. So Coldwell Banker sells more homes valued at $1 million or more than any other brand in the market in the U.S. and around the world. So we see a lot of this. And one of the biggest trends we saw initially was folks who had listed their secondary residence, oftentimes a beach place or a mountain place, they moved into that property and took that listing off the market. That constrained the listing inventory and drove some upward price movement as well. And what we're seeing is those listings come back on at an even faster rate than lower price listings right now. So we're seeing, obviously, the market's trying to seek an equilibrium, and we're trying to get listings on the market to meet that strong buyer demand.
Interesting. Well, maybe that's a hopeful sign for everybody if they're moving out of the mountain house and maybe things are starting to normalize. Brian, fascinating, and the bedroom looks great. Thanks very much for joining me.
Thank
I don't
you.
Think the middle schooler keeps it that clean, but if so, you know, congratulations.
Oh, if I tilted the camera, you'd see the value of staging.
Yeah, exactly. You know it better than anyone. Thanks, Ryan. Ryan Gorman is the CEO of Coldwell Banker Real Estate. To the markets now, where stocks may be taking a breather today after rallying over the past week. But when you go inside the averages, some sectors in particular have been knocking it out of the park the past 2 months. The retail ETF is actually up 40% off over the past 2 months. The Dow Jones Internet ETF is up 42%, and the energy ETF is up nearly 60%. So have investors missed their chance at these sector rallies, or are more opportunities ahead? Joining me now to talk about that, Brian Belsky is Chief Investment Strategist at BMO Capital Markets, and Chris Toomey is Managing Director at Morgan Stanley Private Wealth Management. Great to have you both here. So, Brian, I don't know how passionate you are about investing by sectors, but are there places right now that you think still have a lot of value, or would you stick with the places that have been outperforming?
It's a great question. Thanks for having us on, Evans. I think that the thing you have to think about with respect to the retail ETF, remember, you have a huge weighting in Amazon, right? So the Amazon machine is clearly dominated the performance of consumer discretionary. But I'll remind everyone, you know, back in 2008 when I was at another firm, I came out with a strong overweight recommendation of consumer discretionary. You always want to buy consumer discretionary when the economy is heading into recession. Typically and historically, consumer discretionary is number one performing sector coming out of recession. Chances are that's going to happen again. But, you know, the components of consumer discretionary clearly are different, Kelly, clearly are different with Amazon dominating like they are. But also, too, think about this. You have situations like hotels and restaurants that are more value contrarian names that are going to clearly, some of the leaders clearly are going to have a huge recovery as well. We have exposure in some of the portfolios that we run for BMO Private Wealth in names like Marriott and Starbucks. But I think the bigger theme in consumer discretionary, quite frankly, is lifestyle. And one of our biggest positions have been Lululemon. We've owned it for a long time. And we kind of look at Lululemon as the next Levi's, as the next jeans. We're wearing them at home now, working from our home office. We're wearing them less because we're not going to the gym.
Yeah, I don't know about so I think it already is the next Levi's.
Well, yeah, I mean, it happened. That's a great story to think about, a stock that led prior to COVID, during COVID, and coming out of COVID. Same thing happens with respect to the Apple, Amazon, Google, Microsoft. These are names that led before COVID, during COVID, and we think are going to lead after.
Okay, Chris, let me turn to you on that note. Same things. I know you have a lot of the same clients. What kind of investments and places are you putting their funds to work?
No, I think I'd be in agreement with Brian. I think the strong are going to continue to get stronger as they have been through this whole crisis. So we are maintaining a strong exposure to quality domestic growth companies. We think, though, that we're starting to see a change in leadership. We're seeing small cap starting to outperform large cap. We're also starting to see some of the cyclicals play very well. I think the area that I think is providing some real interesting opportunities and things that you need to be paying attention to is what's going on in the bond market. I don't think most people are talking about how expensive the bond market is. They keep focusing in on the equity market. But the 30-year this year has returned almost 25%, which is amazing given the environment that we're in. In addition, I think there's a lot of opportunity, select opportunity in high yield. We'd also be looking at areas in the preferred market, the municipal market.
But just to be clear, Chris, say that, you know, the 30-year, I think you said, has returned 25%, but that fixed income is expensive, does that mean you would avoid those parts of it and be buying more of the high yield? I mean, is expensive a good thing or not?
Expensive would not be a good thing here right now. I think if you look at the 10-year, we're looking at 2/3% return. We just changed our expectations for fixed income over the next 20 years to be about 1.5%. And one of the things that we're particularly concerned about right now is inflation picking up. As we start to see the economy getting back, we start to see supply getting back online and demand potentially outperforming supply, we could start to see inflation starting to pick up. We saw, as you mentioned earlier, energy prices going up 50%. And as we all know, inflation is the killer with regards to fixed income investing. So we'd be very careful with regards to our fixed income exposure. We'd be looking at maybe selectively adding to municipals, selectively adding to preferred.
Got it.
But we would be very careful with regards to investment grade credit right now.
One other area that both of you are kind of tiptoeing into, or Brian, as you put it, it's the best bottom fishing candidate is the big banks. You know, is that name dependent, or, you know, is it just the sector as a whole you think might have some value?
No, we think the big banks in particular, Kelly, because they have multi-divisional assets and lines of businesses. So, for instance, J.P. Morgan, Morgan Stanley, Goldman, Bank of America, we think those are going to be the ones in the United States that kind of lead the way. I think it's going to be really difficult going forward with the NIM, net interest margin, being crushed, especially with respect to the regional banks. And they don't, quite frankly, have the scale. And I think just because of the strength in the balance sheets, they're going to be able to come in and underbid a lot of these commercial loans. I mean, I just get really bullish listening to Chris talk about bonds because I just think that if you're looking at a 1.5% return and the mythical inflation that we've been looking for 38 years in our country, you know, I don't think it's going to come anytime soon. And I think the key thing that has to happen is we haven't had this big rotation out of bonds and into stocks yet. Remember, in 2019, more people were buying stocks. Or, I'm sorry, more people bought bonds than they bought stocks. So at the end of the day, we still have a massive rotation, we think, still sitting in money markets. We've talked about this on the network today.
Yeah.
But then also fixed income assets coming back to equities. And that's why high-quality U.S. equities, we believe, are going to be the home for the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, I see you jumping off the seat just talking about it. points taken. Guys, thank you both. Brian Belsky of BMO, Chris Toomey of Morgan Stanley Private Wealth Management. We appreciate it. Tune into the Closing Bell today for an exclusive interview with Atlanta Fed President Raphael Bostic. That'll be at 3 p.m. Eastern time. Of course, we just got the Fed minutes, so I have a lot of questions for him about negative rates or capping interest rates and the outlook for the economy and so much more. Coming up, oil is now on pace for its best month ever. And the oil stocks, as you can see there, are making a big comeback. Some of these names are up 40 to 60% in the case of Halliburton. We'll talk about what's behind this move in particular and whether it can continue. And tensions with China have been heating up surrounding the coronavirus. Now the U.S. is escalating the battle, trying to delist Chinese companies. We'll look at what's at stake and what it'll mean for investors. The Exchange will be back after this. Welcome back. We have a market flash on Facebook. Today, it's a push into the workplace. Julia Borson here with that news for us. Julia?
That's right, Kelly. Mark Zuckerberg right now talking about Facebook's commitment to the business of workplace communications, saying he projects that up to half of employees will end up working from home. He announced that Workplace, which is similar to Microsoft Teams and Slack, now has companies paying for more than 5 million monthly active users. That's 2 million more than back in October. It's still just a fraction the size of Microsoft Teams, which just reported 44 million daily active users, and smaller than Slack, which announced 12 million daily active users last year. Zuckerberg also announcing the introduction of Workplace Rooms. That's a video calling space similar to Zoom for up to 50 people, and an expansion of the consumer tool they announced last month. Also announcing Oculus for Business, which will enable companies in companies' IT departments to program those Oculus VR headsets, of course, also important as people work from home. Guys, back over to you.
Julia, there was one
Zoom shares down over 2% on this.
Whew. Yeah. I mean, again, this is a major entry into this space. And I'm reminded of how the online sort of shopping names reacted after the Facebook Shopify news the other day. It was this other headline here as well that caught my eye. Not so much as what it says about Facebook as about all, you know, the workplace. Broadly speaking, they say they expect eventually about half of their employees will work from home. That's a big, I mean, it sounds like he means that half, you know, half of them will work from home for good.
Yes. No, I think that what Zuckerberg is talking about right now, he's speaking on his Facebook page, is the idea that there's going to be a total shift in the way people work. People will be working from home who never thought they could be working from home before. And this is just going to be the new normal. So I think these tools are really trying to address that while generating new revenue for Facebook.
Ah, yes, that too. Julia, we appreciate it. Julia Borston. Let's turn to crude oil now, which has mounted a serious comeback. It's up 80% this month and tracking for its best month since inception on the NYMEX in 1983. Meanwhile, the U.S. gasoline ETF that tracks the price of RBOB is up nearly 70% in a month. And all these big moves aren't spilling over to the energy giants. Exxon and Chevron seeing returns of only 9 and 12% over the past month. For more on this, I'm joined by Jim Yorio, who is managing director at TJM Institutional Services and a CNBC contributor. Jim, so what are your thoughts? I mean, what are investors telling us about, you know, hey, this rebound isn't going to do enough to change or get us more interested in these energy giants?
Well, first of all, the 80% move that you mentioned has to be viewed in the lens of that little over a month ago May debacle where we traded down to negative 40, whatever it was. So that was a month ago. So that whole thing was about storage problems, right? So the 80% we've moved higher because some of those have been alleviated. And we're seeing that because we're seeing a bit of tighter spreads too. There was a little bit of a draw in Cushing, which means to me that the market is being a little more creative to solve storage issues. But at the end of the day, the most important thing to me is that we were then pricing in basically the end of the world economically, and market's jobs is to overprice things in. It seemed to me that that was exaggerated, probably not by much. So now we're seeing the rally too. So yes, we've seen an 80% rally. We're just back to where we were at the end of April. I see 35.85 as being a very important point in the August contract. And I moved out to the August contract because I don't want to have to worry about those storage issues like we did in May before. But again, it's a good thing that we're rallying. The fact that the big integrateds aren't following too has to be viewed in the fact that the futures contract was just absolutely pummeled by issues that didn't really involve those big companies back then.
So you would be a buyer of this space, or you have to wait and test those price levels?
I think we're going to test 3585. I think is okay. Again, we've come 75-80% as we've established, right? So to see a little bit of a pullback nearer that 30 level, I think from a technical standpoint seems very reasonable to me right now. But the story is getting better. That part is hard to argue. Things are reopening. It was just announced yesterday that in Illinois, restaurants are opening a week from Friday, which is important to me because I own a restaurant in Illinois. So those are big things. And, you know, if we got to now see some real live demand pick up, but I definitely think we could see 40 in the next few weeks after a little pullback to 30.
All right. Jim, thanks. Getting right to it as always. We appreciate it. And I love the artwork.
Thank you very much.
Jim Yorio of TJM Institutional Services. Coming up, as the world races to develop new vaccines, experts are starting to question the safety of moving so quickly. We'll look at the risks it's posing. Plus, working from home has become the norm for millions, and it's a perfect scenario for hackers. How much would it cost a company to secure all of these home offices? A lot. That story is ahead. Remember, you can always watch or listen to us live on the go on the CNBC app. We're back in two. Welcome back now to the very latest in the coronavirus pandemic. Over to Sue Herrera. Sue?
Thank you very much, Kelly. Here's what we know at this hour, everyone. Italy's death toll and new coronavirus cases both slightly declined today from yesterday. The country's total death toll now stands at over 32,000. That is the third highest in the world after the United States and Britain. Some startling new disease modeling data from Columbia University suggests tens of thousands of lives may have been saved had the country practiced lockdown measures just 1 week earlier. Researchers say if lockdowns began on March 8th, 36,000 deaths would have been avoided. The research has not yet been peer-reviewed. And New York's Mayor Bill de Blasio said today that the city is on track to begin phase one of reopening in the first half of June, which would allow for curbside pickup, in-store drop-off at retail stores, and the resumption of construction and manufacturing jobs. You can always get more on states reopening by going to CNBC.com. Kelly, back to you.
All right, Sue, thanks very much. As the world races to develop vaccines for COVID-19 at a record pace, there's still a lot we don't know about the virus, and that combination of speed and uncertainty is raising safety concerns. Meg Terrell is here with more. Meg?
Hi, Kelly. Well, when it comes to vaccines, the safety bar is even higher because, remember, these are medicines being given to healthy people to try to protect them against disease. And, of course, in a pandemic, the scale on which the number of people are going to get these things is massive. The main safety issue that experts are talking about is one known as immune enhancement. And right now, experts tell us that this is really a theoretical issue. It has not been observed in any of the vaccine candidates as of yet. Essentially, what it means is that the vaccine could potentially make the disease more severe. And this is a phenomenon observed with the dengue virus, that if somebody's encountered it once before, the next time they encountered it, it might be worse. It was also seen in RSV vaccine development, and it set that field back for 30 years. We talked with Dr. Paul Stoffels from Johnson & Johnson about this phenomenon and how to avoid it.
That can happen if a vaccine uses certain immune pathways, and we have learned around that, how we can work around it. But it is a disease-enhancing problem which a vaccine could have when it is not correctly developed.
So it's obviously very scary, and the way to avoid that, Kelly, is to make sure you do giant clinical trials to assess safety, even in short timelines. So these companies are talking about tens of thousands of people being tested in the phase threes, Kelly.
Although, yeah, who would they test? I mean, the people, you know what I'm saying? If we want to test everybody before we give it to anybody, that seems like a bit of a catch-22.
That's the issue with clinical trials in general, but it's actually fascinating starting to talk to people about what the structure of the clinical trials will be. They have to go to where the outbreaks are to be able to prove the efficacy. And Dr. Gottlieb has written about this a bit, kind of doing cluster vaccination, so around people you know came into contact with somebody who's sick. That's how they prove the Ebola vaccine works, and it's a good way of showing efficacy fast.
Nice. I see the little paw in the background there, too, Meg. We appreciate it.
Sleeping dog.
Yeah. Our Meg Terrell. Coming up, tensions with China are flaring up with fingers being pointed on coronavirus as some members of Congress want to send a bill to China for the pandemic. How bad could the escalation get, and what will it mean for our markets? We'll dig into that. Plus, tech has been leading this comeback higher. The NASDAQ is just 5% from all-time highs. Are valuations getting too rich, and does it matter? We'll debate that. Welcome back. Quick check on the markets about half past the hour. We've halved the losses. The Dow's down about 95 points. We are down 200 at the lows. It's a 0.4% decline. The biggest laggard today actually is the NASDAQ, down a little more than 0.2%. In terms of sectors, energy and utilities are the big laggards in terms of the S&P 500. We're only talking about declines of about 1%. Industrials, interestingly enough, is the only sector in the green, so it's a really mixed bag today. Disney, ExxonMobil, Coca-Cola, those are the names that are most weighing on the Dow today. Disney's down about 2.3%. Another 2.4 million Americans filed for jobless claims last week, and that brings the total to over 38 million in the past 9 weeks. So while we're facing historic job losses here at home, millions in China have also lost their jobs or income, and that's putting pressure on the Chinese government to come up with new policies to boost growth. Eunice Yoon joins me now live from Beijing with more on that. Hi, Eunice.
Hi, Kelly. Well, compared to the U.S., China looks like it's in better shape with the official unemployment rate at just under 6%. But some economists believe that the actual number could be not only double, but maybe triple that number. So we went to a nearby factory zone to see just how bad things really are.
Factories in this industrial zone in Beijing ship products out to the world. Not so much these days because the coronavirus is dealing a blow to production, jobs, and incomes. Factories here employ hundreds of thousands of people who travel from all over China to work in the capital. But some managers tell us only 40% of their workers are back due to weak global demand. Fewer factory workers has meant fewer customers for canteen owner Zhang Junjun. We earn less than a quarter of last year's sales, she says. Prior to the pandemic, her place drew in a large lunchtime crowd, pulling in $1,100 a day. She had 12 employees, no more. I can only afford to keep less than half the staff, she says. Other mom-and-pop stores here are struggling, too. Cigarette shops, convenience marts, and restaurants. Not only are there fewer factory workers coming, but locals say the factories don't want their people to go out much to eat and shop because of the virus. Qi Dabao lost his job 2 months ago. The former waiter is looking for work. To survive, he's cut his spending in half. It's more difficult to find a job, he says, and so hard to earn money now. True for China and the rest of the world.
And ensuring employment is going to be a top priority at the National People's Congress, which opens in just a matter of hours. President Xi Jinping had chaired a meeting about it recently. And as you know, Kelly, maintaining stability and jobs are is very, very important and seen as related to each other here in China.
And they've tried so much over the past several years, Eunice, to do so much spending, all the ghost towns, all the building things to try to keep people employed while then trying to pivot to more of a consumer-driven, economy. What tack do you think they're going to take now? What's the easiest way to guarantee that people are going to be able to work?
Well, that is a very good question. I think one of the criticisms of the Chinese government has been exactly what you had said, which is that a lot of the policies don't necessarily directly tackle the fact that China doesn't have a very strong safety net, but instead is more about infrastructure spending or trying to stabilize big companies in order to allow them to hold on to their workers. So there has been some discussion about more unemployment benefits, or at least in some way making it easier for people to be able to claim unemployment portion of their benefits. But it's still a big question mark as to exactly how far down that road the government is going to go.
Yeah. Eunice, thanks. It's great to see you. Appreciate you sticking around for us. Eunice Yoon in Beijing. Let's stick with China, talk about tensions between the two countries ratcheting up over issues surrounding the pandemic, and both sides are pointing the finger on who's to blame. Not only that, but the Senate just approved new legislation that could ultimately bar many Chinese companies from listing on U.S. exchanges. What does it all mean for our trade deal and the markets? Joining me now is Patrick Chovanec, the economic advisor at Silvercrest Asset Management and a longtime China watcher. Patrick, it's good to see you. So, yeah, I guess I wonder to what extent the public is going to blame the president or blame China, over the pandemic and how that's all likely to play out for the rest of the year.
Well, everybody wants the public, both in China and the United States, to blame somebody else.
Right.
And that's partly why coronavirus has accelerated the already existing tensions between the United States and China. And, you know, there are a lot of observers who say that the relationship is at its lowest ebb since, well, at least 1989, the Tiananmen crackdown. And some say even more, even worse than that, because there are so many different fronts of confrontation opening up.
Yeah, so where do we go from here? You know, if I'm an investor and, for example, I've been investing in Alibaba, is there the real chance that they might have to delist even for a while? Or is that Senate legislation part of just posturing back and forth with China right now?
It's difficult to say how much of this is bark and how much is bite. You know, obviously, there's a dynamic here where politicians in both countries want to deflect what they worry it will be blame for the way that coronavirus has played out and its economic impact onto the other country. And that's heating up some of the rhetoric. But there are, like I said, longstanding issues between the United States and China that there's been a shift in D.C., not just over the past few months, but over the past few years, towards a much harder view of China and the challenges that it presents. It's been a bipartisan one. It's not just been led by President Trump.
Absolutely.
And there's also been a hardening on the other side in China, where they view they have the view that there's much less to learn from the West, and they're much more confident in confronting the United States.
Right. They've figured it all out, and now they have the heft to kind of throw back our way. You know, I think it's interesting when I think about the dependence of corporate America on China in terms of growth, manufacturing and so forth. I mean, you say and you write here that there's literally a view towards viewing a shift in view towards China, not as a difficult partner or rival, but as an enemy. I mean, how should American companies feel about doing business with a country whose leadership we feel is an enemy of the United States?
It's going to be a real challenge. I mean, you had Senator Hawley get up in the Senate yesterday and basically, you know, say that. And a lot of companies are going to have to make choices. It's going to be different for different companies. You know, if you're in a technology space, you may have to decide whether you can do business with companies like Huawei, either as a customer or a supplier. If you are based in Hong Kong, the news has come out now that China is going to impose, new laws on Hong Kong, which may call its status into question, and how the United States is going to respond to that is an open question. There are other tensions relating to Chinese companies that are listed in the United States, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
That has actually been an issue for many years, but it's kind of been off the front burner. And now these tensions have brought it back on the front burner and raised a question mark over to what that status will be.
Yeah, and it's
If you read a prospectus of Alibaba, you would be aware that this issue was out there, but it's kind of been, you know, not a live issue for the past several years.
Absolutely. But it's definitely a potent tool. In that sense, I'm not surprised it's being used right now. My final question to you, when we see these headlines out of China talking about how they might retaliate against the U.S., depending on if we move forward with the delisting or other things right now, what is the most likely form of retaliation that they have and are willing to use, do you think?
I think when it comes to delisting, there's going to be a movement, and there was back when this was an issue a couple of years ago, a movement to just delist Chinese companies and list them back in China, which is now more plausible than it might have been in the past. In the end, that actually might be a solution, and it might be a good thing. Not every Chinese company necessarily belongs on U.S. exchanges if there is an issue with them complying with U.S. securities laws. But the question will be, how disruptive will that process be? Will it be a cooperative process, which I think it could be, or will it be more about, you know, politicians throwing bombs at each other and then with investors being in the crossfire?
But anything you think we should be, you know, thinking about it, if we do move forward with that move? I mean, people throw around things like, oh, they're going to sell our they're not going to sell our treasury. What do you think might be more likely?
Well, buckle up. I mean, you know, China, it's unlikely that China is simply going to dump treasuries. I've argued in the past that is not really a plausible option for them. The United States have been threatening to, you know, selectively default on U.S. treasuries in order to claim reparations from China over coronavirus. I don't think that's really going to happen. But, you know, there might be talk about that, and it might raise some questions in people's minds. So the big concern here is how much of this is rhetoric.
Yeah.
and positioning, you know, to a new reality in relationship, new kind of hard edge reality between China and the United States, and how much of it is actually going to be translate into actions and things that create negative economic headwinds at a time where the global economy is really fragile.
Exactly. And like you said,
and, you know, we already saw last year the trade tensions between the United States and China have a negative effect on the U.S. economy. It wasn't anything compared to what we've seen under coronavirus, but it did put a lot of business confidence on its back foot, and manufacturing sector went into contraction. So if we see that come back again, if there, for instance, the ceasefire, the U.S. trade deal between the United States and China falls apart and we go back to escalating tariffs, you know, that uncertainty comes back at a time when the U.S. economy and the Chinese economy is a lot more fragile than they were.
Yep. And the world economy, big contrast from 08 when there was more cooperation. Patrick, thanks very much. Patrick Jovanic talking through how this might continue to play out today. Coming up on The Exchange, San Francisco giants Square and Twitter all saying they'll let employees permanently work from home, and they may not be the last ones. We'll look at the consequences that could have for the city. Plus, how the working from home trend could cost companies millions in security. All that when The Exchange comes right back. Welcome back. As work from home becomes a more permanent arrangement for many companies, the ripple effect of the new normal is far-reaching. Kate Rooney has a look at the potential fallout for San Francisco in particular, and Eamon Javers is looking at the cost to companies as they try to keep home systems safe from hackers. Kate, let's start with you.
Hey, Kelly, we're seeing a wave of companies going remote, and depending on how many tech giants follow suit, could have some big implications for Silicon Valley. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg just saying that his company would allow most employees to request a permanent change to work remotely. He expects, quote, a substantial shift towards remote work in the next decade. We also had Shopify CEO saying just now that after next year, most employees will work remotely as well. He says, quote, office centricity is over. Twitter and Square were the first U.S. tech giants to announce permanent work from home. According to a new study out today, a bulk of those tech workers are willing to pick up and leave the Bay Area. Two out of three people, or 66% of respondents, would consider relocating if given the option to work remotely. The firm called Blind surveyed more than 4,000 people for that. And this week, Visa, MasterCard, and Spotify were the latest companies to extend work-from-home orders through the end of this year. A lot of buzz, Kelly, around the potential fallout for real estate in San Francisco specifically. Leases here are often month-to-month, making it easier for folks to pick up and leave.
Ooh, I did not realize that. We'll see if it accelerates. I'm sure a lot of other communities would welcome the influx. Kate, thanks. Kate Rooney in San Francisco. Now let's get to Eamon Javers, who has a story that it's not all roses working from home, a big problem for companies. Eamon.
Yeah, that's right. You just heard Kate talking about the fallout in terms of real estate. Well, the fallout in terms of security is also significant here for a lot of companies, which basically in the space of about 5 days in March moved millions of workers out of the office and into a work from home environment. You can see me. I'm standing in my living room right here doing exactly the same thing. And part of the security problem for that is you've got now got all of this company data that's now traveling over family routers for the Internet that never were designed to have this kind of security problem. That they were dealing with. So you got a lot of company data now flowing over the same routers that your kids' Wi-Fi is on, your kids' video games, your kids' social media, all of that, one security expert tells me, is a witch's brew of security risk for American companies that are all trying to deal with this. How much would that cost to fix if you wanted to legitimately secure all of those seats at home in terms of the corporate standard? Well, Mike Convertino of the cybersecurity firm Arceo ran an estimate for me, and it's wide-ranging here, but he says somewhere between $247 and $1,755 per employee, depending on what their home internet setup is like and exactly what improvements they might need. But you're talking about potentially $1,000 a seat for companies to secure all of that work from home technology and separate the kids' stuff out from the parent stuff, the corporate data from the family data, all of that very tricky to do, and especially at a time, Kelly, when I'm told a lot of the corporate security guys were deputized during this rush to get these companies into the work-from-home posture. The corporate security guys were actually just helping to send laptops out to people and get wiring up and running and make sure that the Wi-Fi was functioning in everybody's home. They were doing IT jobs, not security jobs, just at a time when security was the most vulnerable, Kelly.
Yeah, and the only thing I wonder, Eamon, obviously it has a big one-time cost, but going forward, would it be cheaper for companies to, you know, to spend on having people working from home than having them in the office? I could see the argument being made in either direction.
Yeah, look, I think the bottom line here is that work from home is not free, right? And not everybody can do it. You're going to have to spend some money as a company to make sure that people have the security, that they have the tools that they need. A lot of people are going to need office space, desks, furniture, all of that. If this is going to become semi-permanent, as Kate was just talking about, companies are going to need to spend some money behind this. And that's money that they haven't really spent right now, because the assumption was this was just going to be a temporary situation. If that becomes permanent,
yeah,
you're looking at a big spend there.
Absolutely. And in an odd way, maybe that's good for the economy, although I'm sure it'll hurt margins and so forth. Eamon, thanks. It's a really important point. Eamon Javers with the corporate security angle for us. Coming up, tech taking charge. The sector is the only positive one in the market for the year. And the Dow Jones Internet ETF is up 40% in 2 months. What about valuations? Have they gotten too high? One analyst says no, and the FANG names could rally another 25%. That's after this. Welcome back. We're getting some breaking news headlines from NEC Director Larry Kudlow, who is speaking at a Washington Post event. Mr. Kudlow saying it's possible the U.S. unemployment rate could still be in the double digits in November as we head towards the election. Kudlow adding he believes that extending unemployment benefits would be a disincentive for people to return to work and that the U.S.-China trade deal remains intact. Ahead, is tech the Teflon sector? One analyst says yes, valuations may be high, but that's never stopped the stocks from rallying. We'll debate where tech goes from here. Welcome back. Take a look at the past 2 months for some of the biggest tech names. Facebook, Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, and Alphabet, all jumping between 30 and 60%. Facebook and Amazon are hitting all-time highs again today. At what point do their valuations start to get out of hand? For more on that, I'm joined by Dan Ives, Managing Director at Wedbush Securities, and Steve Milunovich is Tech Strategist at Wolf Research. Welcome to both of you. And Dan, I'll begin with you because you think these companies could kind of double the returns they've already made in the past couple of months. Talk about why.
Look, I mean, to me, it's about the secular growth drivers. I mean, if you look across large cap tech, those continue to be strong. E-commerce, social media, cloud, and even in this just horrific COVID-19 pandemic, the strong are getting stronger. And I think you're seeing more investors focus on the secular growth names, which is why I think we're still in the middle innings of this rally with large cap tech. We see these stocks up another 20 to 25% over the next 6 months.
Okay. Steve, would you also see that kind of upside?
Well, I'm probably a little bit more cautious. Dan's absolutely right. The secular trends are fantastic. But obviously, a lot of these stocks have benefited from the short-term trends in terms of COVID. So we always argue that momentum is more important than valuation to tech stock performance. But the fact is, we are at an extreme now. We've now got multiples that are actually higher than at the market peak February 19th. And what's particularly interesting is a lot of the mid and small cap software names that came into the year selling over 10 times revenue are up 30% this year. A lot of those names were bought. So as Microsoft has said, we've kind of collapsed 2 years into 2 months of digital transformation here. And these stocks obviously have benefited from that. But in some cases, I think we're getting overbought and valuations are historically high.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, Dan, that if we've accelerated 2 years of development, why haven't we accelerated 2 years worth of gains for these companies? And if we're bringing a lot of that forward, won't they need to take a break at some point?
Yeah, I mean, I think as Steve talked about, especially in cloud, I mean, cloud, you're seeing an accelerated growth cycle, I'd say pull forward by anywhere from 9 to 18 months in terms of what we're seeing on enterprises. But I think you're seeing the valuations, investors are digesting it. It's a more narrow rally, what you see in large cap tech, but I think it's going to be a spread to more cloud, cybersecurity, as well as even on the social media side. But I think on the other side, this dark valley, the stronger getting stronger in terms of FANG names. That's why I think you're going to start to see some new paradigms in terms of the valuation on some of the parts, despite antitrust worries, which continues to probably be the lingering risk out there in the eyes of the street.
Where are you on antitrust, Steve? And if these companies, you know, Amazon's gotten a lot of press lately as could it achieve a $2 or $2.5 trillion market cap? Could Jeff Bezos be the first trillionaire? You know, how might you expect Washington in the years ahead to respond to that if they can't retroactively break up these companies?
It's going to be tricky. Obviously, we are hearing more about antitrust with Google recently, but I think the general view among investors is that the pandemic has probably helped these large companies. For the most part, they've been helping the government get through this. We've seen that with Apple and Google with Android and iOS. I've always felt that while regulation can certainly cause problems for these companies and soften that up, eventually what gets you when you get to the top of the hill in tech is disruptive technologies. And when we look at the new technologies like AI, Microsoft, Apple, Amazon, they're the leaders. So it does suggest that these large platform companies have potentially another good 3 to 5 years ahead of them.
So, Dan, we talked about how you see the, you know, kind of upside for the next couple months of decent sized rallies still for these names. What would you, I mean, if you have to kind of start thinking about what it looks like beyond that, does your view start to change and moderate?
Look, I think a lot of it's really going to be cloud, especially when you look at names like, you know, Microsoft and Amazon. I think those are one where they're seeing considerable strength. I think when you look overall at antitrust on the other side of the dark valley, it is going to get a lot hotter in the 202 area code for these companies. That's a lingering risk. But as Steve said, I think most likely it's fines, although there's many twists and turns this can take. But fundamentally, you take a step back, and I can tell you, talking to investors throughout this whole pandemic, it comes down to the secular growth trends and the valuations re-rating. That's what's happening here.
And Steve, I have a lot of names here that you think people should be looking at in the internet space, Shopify, Twitter, Zillow, also names in software, services, semiconductors. On hardware, are you still cautious?
We are. You know, it's an economically sensitive area. And one of the places that is being hurt here is on-premise computing. So the NetApps and HPs and so forth that sell into the data center are the ones that are being hurt. Instead, people are going to the cloud at an accelerated pace, as Dan said. So we're still overweight internet, equal weight software, underweight hardware.
All right. A lot in there to think about, especially if this rally keeps going. Thank you both, Steve Milunovich and Dan Ives, talking about the tech breakout today. And that does it for The Exchange. Thanks so much for tuning in.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day, same time, same place.